So welcome everyone to tonight's Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobby that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight we're going to have a chance to review CCL's Transformational Organizing Guide. The guide is a series of pillars that describes what we call transformational organizing, which really is focused on helping each of us as CCL leaders develop and strengthen our own leadership development and capacity throughout the organization. So by practicing these ideas in our groups, we're going to increase the number of highly engaged and motivated people that we work with and enable us to help reach our own goals. A little bit of backstory, we wrote this guide back in 2017 after working with Dr. Hari Hahn's book, How Organizations Develop Activists, as well as her plenary talk at the 2017 National Conference. We also focused on a book written by Neil Doshi and Lindsay McGregor called Primed to Perform. And both of these works really helped us as organizers focus on what we are already intuitively doing, but helped us think about them more directly and with greater depth. So to help me walk through and explain each of these pillars tonight, I'm going to be joined by Madeline Parra, CCL's wonderful president, as well as Ricky Bradley, CCL's IT director. And if we've done our job well, after our training tonight, you're going to walk away with the following three learning goals. We'll have the chance to highlight the five pillars of transformational organizing to help each of us strengthen our leadership development in our chapters. We're going to think through why each of these pillars is important in building capacity throughout CCL. And we'll also jump into actually taking action and thinking through how we can put into practice each of these pillars within your local chapter, your state, your region, your action team, whatever level of organizing you're really involved in within the organization. So we're going to divide this up by basically reviewing each of the five pillars. We'll start with pyramid of engagement. We'll then go to the CCL way. We'll review the conditions that motivate, the elimination of blame, and then the empowerment of our volunteers. So with that, I'd like to just start by acknowledging but this quote that she gave us, and you know, Dr. Hahn's also an advisory board member of CCL, I think really grounds the whole work. And that is, movements work by transforming what people think is possible, all right? And in CCL, we transform what people think is possible for Congress, what they do on climate. And in the process of transforming what people think is possible for themselves to accomplish as well. So regardless of the motivation or the skills a person brings when they join CCL, we succeed when we help our volunteers take that next step in becoming part of our movement. And in turn, obviously, empowered volunteers help us reach our big organizational goals. So with that framework, let's really start discussing each of these five pillars. And I'll take the first one, and then I'll pass it to Madeline to review the second. Ricky will take the third, and then I'll jump back in for the fourth and fifth. But you may be familiar with this pyramid of engagement. You may have heard it discussed. You may have seen it in a guide from Dr. Hahn, from our own work. This image is adapted from her book. Obviously, just like our elected officials, our goal as CCL leaders is to move our volunteers up this pyramid of engagement. So you can already see kind of the base level all the way to the top. That arrow is cultivating agency up the pyramid. And at the bottom of the pyramid are the joiners. They have that basic connection with the organization, and you might engage in actions, you know, at that level, like signing up for our email list initially, maybe donating money, clicking around the website. This initial engagement, though, what sets joiners apart from others is that it's a non-committal level of involvement. And, you know, as affiliates of the organization, it's great to have people like that. You know, as a group leader, as a state coordinator, you don't have to worry about them. Don't get rid of them. We know sometimes life circumstances change where they can float in and out of that role. But it's really a crucial component to think about engaging volunteers on this base level of the pyramid to understand how whatever barriers they might have in moving them up exist. And by doing that, really helping them become that next level of task doers that you can see here. So task doers are those that kind of ramp up their effort to take more actions, not just being a collectivist, but actually attending your monthly meeting, logging on to one of these trainings, at this next level, you know, volunteers take actions without taking responsibility for their outcomes, though. And that really is the distinction between a task doer, somebody that's doing a specific discrete action, and a role taker, that third level as we move up, who is actually taking responsibility for an outcome or an area of the group functioning that they see. So again, role takers are actually somebody that take on more responsibility or ownership of an outcome, such as I'm going to make sure that 50 people from our chapter attend the upcoming national conference. Task doers bring food to the next monthly meeting or sign up to call their member of Congress from the monthly calling campaign. Both of those roles are crucial, but in this pyramid of engagement, that role taker is moving up that pyramid by making sure that they're stepping up to not only do a discrete task, but taking responsibility for the outcome and enlisting others in helping make that possible. So lastly, as people become more engaged, more thoughtful, that highest level of the pyramid are those that what we term become leadership developers. And that's actually from Dr. Hahn's work as well, I should say. So when volunteers start developing that leadership capacity of others, at this stage, the volunteer recognizes that developing other advocates is a crucial part of achieving our shared goals as CCL. And this, when you realize that our success not only lies in your engagement, but in helping cultivate that in others, that is the very heart of transformational organizing. And one of the key things in engaging people, and we'll get into this with some of the other the actual pillars, not just in this levels discussion, is that we come into this organization or any organization we might be affiliated with at various levels. So not everyone joins CCL as a joiner or an affiliate. Some people may already, you know, come in guns a-blazing as a role taker or already have that kind of firm vision that I want to join to do this specific task. And that is entirely great that we have such a diversity even from the get-go of our volunteer base. And as group leaders, state, regional coordinators, action team leaders, CCL group leaders overall, your role is to nudge them and support them where they're at, but also find out in kind of developing these relationships where they're interested in growing into. And the key thing that I would ask each of us, let me just kind of define each of those a little bit more thoroughly, is the following question. So what do you think in your experience empowers volunteers? As a transformational organization, CCL places that empowerment as key to our mission, to our strategy, and all of us as CCL leaders really have to match that size of the problem we're tackling in the groups that we're leading. But what we often face, I'm guessing at least for you, it's similar as it is for me, the people that we meet with don't feel like they're up to the task. They don't have the skill set yet. They don't have the confidence. They don't have the time. And that's the real tension here. How do you work with the hand that you've been dealt, the people that you have in your culture, to support volunteers in moving up that engagement pyramid? And so this key question of what empowers our volunteers, again, that arrow kind of reveals the clue, but the key word that Dr. Hahn would highlight is it lies in cultivating agency. And essentially what that simply means, it's a fancy word, for helping people reach their potential as leaders by developing their skills and confidence. And so when you help cultivate agency in your volunteers, you help give them the knowledge and skill set to complete tasks. You give them room to try out ideas, to have the space to make mistakes, to learn from them and share them with others, and obviously have that safe community to share and grow. And ultimately, you know you're doing your job well when volunteers can look at each other and say, I can't believe we just did that. I can't believe we just got 50,000 contacts to the Senate or over 10,000 people collectively to call their member of Congress in the House. Or I had so much fun trying this new thing I never thought I could do. Whatever that might be, the remaining pillars for tonight are really providing that balance of support and guiding us on how to achieve that. So with that, I'm actually going to invite you for this first pillar to reflect on where you've seen agency being cultivated in your own groups in the chat. But I'm actually going to pass it specifically to Madeline for this second pillar. So with that, I will pass it to you, Madeline.
The second pillar that I think is often taken for granted which is the importance of an organization's culture. If you think about it, you know, the difference between coming into a room and being made to feel welcome, being in a culture that says hello to you and people stop and engage you in conversation and want to know about you, that's a very inviting culture, versus coming into an organization where the tone is like, sit there and be quiet and wait to be told what to do. The culture is really critical, more than anything else, actually. So it's one of the ways that we empower people and motivate them. And one of the things he can still be heard to say, and which I will repeat sometimes, is that we like to be 100% for the work, you know, all in for what we need to get done on the climate, and 100% for each other. And so that kind of statement's a statement of our culture that again says that relationships are what's important to us. This has been a big challenge for us during the pandemic, because you have to work kind of extra to be relational on Zoom. And for some folks, it's like, if you just do business on Zoom, like nobody has a chance to get to know each other. But one of the things Hari Han found is that the relationships matter at least as much as the cause to people and them coming back. Telling people the culture never works as good as living the culture. And another thing Mark did really early on is he observed that people in the climate movement generally tended to be kind of grim and serious about the work. And I mean, that's understandable, like we're worried. But he felt that that was really counterproductive in a lot of ways. Like it's just, you know, too much grim and serious is not very attractive to human beings. And so I credit him with this, and I just think it comes naturally to him more than some people. Like, he's a light, humorous, engaging, funny, little bit outrageous guy. And he really deliberately tried to help us not take ourselves so seriously, and to work some play into it and some fun and be a little silly here and there. Now, that doesn't come easy to everybody. I'm actually kind of a shy person. CCL sort of pushed me towards more extroverted. And so I'm better than I used to be. So my advice to you is, when you can't get to be what you think is needed yourself, whether that's you need a policy expert and that's not you, or you need to be a social butterfly and that's not you, that's where you ask somebody else for help. You know, like you notice, like, who is good at that? And on the subject of play, in some chapters, it's like, okay, who's good at that is the younger people. And so let's give them a role. Like their role is meeting lightener upper. And it doesn't have to take the whole meeting. In 5 minutes, you can get people laughing. So you get to get inventive there and think of yourself as a team, so that the things you think you can't do, A, you can grow into, and B, you can get help with. So that's some thoughts on culture. I would say we try to model the culture in our national call and our conference and our trainings as much as we can. And I guess I would be interested to hear where you've seen the culture modeled for you of CCL well, that other people might want to pick up on. So any experiences you've had?
I think that's such a great example. And again, you know, the thing that really stands out when you read Dr. Han's writing, and you kind of, she does a great span of not just environmental causes, but thinking through, you know, specifically what people are drawn to in any cause, in any social movement. It is, you know, people come for the actual movement, but they stay for the people. And she showed over and over with anecdotes about people that got involved, and they may not have even cared or paid attention to the issue, but they kind of kept hanging around and staying and, you know, getting more activated just because they felt so welcomed. And that is, unfortunately, such an increasingly hard experience for people in their own, you know, civic associations in a time and an era, even in COVID right now, where we're having a really hard time staying connected. So Please keep thinking about those, but to stay on track, let's keep this train rolling, and I'll pass it to Ricky to think through our third pillar of the actual transformational organizing guide.
Thank you, Brett. Edward Deci, a psychologist and intrinsic motivation guru, said this: the proper question is not, how can people motivate others, but rather, how can people create the conditions within which others will motivate themselves? So we should think less about motivating others and more around creating the conditions for others to motivate themselves. A transformational organization is one in which the conditions are right for people to motivate themselves, and how well volunteers perform really stems from what motivates them in the first place. So what drives individual motivation? Now, research shows that motivators generally fall into two buckets: direct and indirect motivators. And some folks refer to these as intrinsic and extrinsic motivators, but we're going to call them direct and indirect motivators because they both motivate, only they actually impact short-term versus long-term motivation. Now, direct motivators increase long-term motivation, which really helps individuals, especially like, or you think about supporters of CCL, be more effective and satisfied. We want long-term motivated supporters. Indirect motivators, they actually lessen some of that long-term motivation. They're really good at short-term motivation, but they lessen or weaken long-term motivation. Those are things like emotional and economic pressure. You know, those are short-term motivators. So let's focus on direct motivators, the ones that strengthen long-term engagement, lead to more engaged, persistent volunteers, and foster the conditions within which people can motivate themselves. And we call these motivators, there's three of them. They're called play, purpose, and potential. Let's start at the beginning. Play. Play is the most powerful motivator. It is finding work that you enjoy. People feel the sense of play at work when the motive that they go to work is the work itself. You work because you enjoy it. And because the play motive is created by work, it is the most powerful motivator. An example of this would be a member of Congress or a congressional staffer who might be a policy wonk, and they really just enjoy crafting legislation, coming up with solutions to ideas. So they would feel at play when they are working on some policy stuff, and that's something that they enjoy. So that's play, the most direct motivator. The next is purpose. And that is when you believe in a greater outcome. A person who's motivated by purpose is not motivated necessarily by the work itself, but they're motivated by an outcome of the work. It's that they value that outcome. You can think a lot of CCL supporters are probably purpose motivated, right? It's not necessarily second nature to us to be organizers, but we know what the outcome is, that we create an engaged citizenry that can go have and develop relationships with the members of Congress, and that's really important. So purpose is the second strongest motivator. Taking the same example or extending the example from a member of Congress or a congressional staffer, a purpose motive might be akin to them seeing that they are there to serve and be in public service. So it's not necessarily that they're excited about writing policy, but they see the purpose of being a public servant as being a value that they outcome. So it's not the work itself, it's the outcome of the work. The final motivator is potential. The final direct motivator is potential. And that is when you have a work that you do that's a step towards a personal goal. And people are motivated by potential. They see the work as a stepping stone to something else in their life. They do an activity because they know it's going to lead to something else, a personal goal. And you can see how a member of Congress or a congressional staffer might be motivated by potential for a higher office, right? That's the potential motivator. Now, just real quick, the indirect motivators, those are motivators, again, that decrease long-term engagement, and they don't create the conditions where people end up motivating themselves, and can include in behaviors like avoiding guilt. That can actually be a motivator, right? You don't want to feel guilty about not doing something. It's kind of a short-term motivator. It doesn't work in the long-term. Performing for rewards, right? That doesn't, organizations that sales goals, those are great short-term things, but they don't tend to help long-term engagement, or working out of habit. It's really important for everyone to identify when any of these negative motivators or indirect motivators are happening and talk, how do we adjust towards the positive direct motivators? So moving away from indirect to the direct motivators. Again, those three indirect motivators are emotional pressure, economic pressure and inertia. I don't think we have any of that at CCL, so that's fine. We might have emotional pressure, not much economic pressure, and definitely no inertia when you just show up because you just have a job and that's what you just show up to do. So we're not going to spend a lot of time here today. Brett and I am not going to go any more into about direct motivators, because really what the research shows is that if we focus our attention on the direct motivators, those indirect motivators tend to sort of fade away on their own. All right, that's all I have. Thanks to everyone for all you do. And back to you, Brett.
Well, thank you, Ricky. So let's talk about that fourth pillar. And this one, I think, if I had to be honest, for me at least, is the hardest one. So I'll just name that. You might find that to be the case yourself as well. But the quote that we start this pillar with is grounded in this recognition that blame kills motivation, experimentation, and the ability to learn from our mistakes. So it might feel kind of odd that this is given equal weight or a whole pillar is devoted to the blame bias, but let's kind of think through what, you know, why that is and what we actually mean when we're talking about the elimination of blame. So despite all that we know already, there's a whole lot of people out there that have made their career on how to motivate people that are social scientists. Why don't we have better functioning organizations and workplaces? If we know so much already, why isn't actually being applied, right? I think the key thing here is that it turns out human beings, you and I, have a tendency to blame each other when things aren't going well, rather than the context or the conditions within which we're operating. And that is called the blame bias. It's inherent. We have it. We have to work through it. It's there. It's real. But it's also not hardwired. At least that Neil and Lindsay, the two authors here, make the argument that it's conditioned. We learn it. And by understanding it, we can eliminate it. So typically, we're more aware of that blame bias in other people than in ourselves, believe it or not. We can notice other people doing it easier than we can notice ourselves doing it. And so the first and the hardest step in kind of learning to recognize when we've fallen into blaming people is just taking a moment to actually recognize and getting this practice of really noticing when it happens for you. Just, you know, again, the simple act of kind of pausing and noticing when you are falling into blame bias is that first step, right? And once we've recognized it, we can start choosing to place blame, replace that with problem solving. And again, the whole key behind why this is so key, blaming the individual leads to a greater sense or a use of kind of sensing other motivators that weaken our performance, those indirect motivators. A great example that we're probably familiar with is something like a manager falling into using emotional pressure to shame somebody, you know, into, you know, performing better because of their blame of kind of a certain lack of delivery on a metric or a goal. Another key thing is our relationship with our members of Congress. I'm guessing that some of you might be in a similar boat. We can blame our member of Congress when they don't share urgency, when they, you know, come back after the 10th meeting and they're still not in a place where they want to publicly support, you know, the Energy Innovation Act or an ambitious climate policy. But again, that blame only locks in our differences. If instead we focus on understanding their situation and making even small changes in that context, it can lead to significant progress over time. We've all known stories. And so really what we're going to try to do here is actually focus on conditions or context and look for ways to create conditions where that intrinsic motivation happens. And the model that is used in this fourth pillar is called the REAP model. You reap what you sow. So let's think about what the REAP model stands for. It's a handy acronym. And that first letter, we'll kind of go through each of these here, is the R is remember. So remember, whenever you find yourself blaming an individual, stop yourself and try out these words. It's kind of a little bit awkward, English, but it's assume positive intent. And what we mean by that is that there's other reasons, chances are, that bad character that explains why they didn't do the task. And again, let's use in this whole kind of example, a volunteer who said that he was going to do something and shows up to the next meeting and didn't do it. You know, we've all been there, right? So we can be frustrated. We can think of them as lazy, irresponsible, untrustworthy, whatever. But let's apply this REAP model to the scenario. So on the remember front, think through the fact that perhaps they actually are a good person and just face some kind of a difficulty that we don't know about yet. And let's jump into E. So explain. And this means that basically you want to start thinking about alternative scenarios. What else may have happened that explain their behavior? Unanticipated life change may have happened. Maybe they had a hard time saying no. That's a curse that I have lived with my whole life. Maybe you have it too. So they said yes to something that they shouldn't have. Maybe they don't know how to do the task and they didn't feel confident in asking for help, or they started feeling bad about how poorly they were doing it and then they kind of hid from you. Whatever it is, that E stands for explaining alternative scenarios. Why else may have that behavior occurred? The A then stands for ask. Assume positive intent, assuming that you are using a positive intent framework, mention what you observed and ask them, bring them into dialogue to draw out more information. And again, do this as objectively as possible with I statements. For example, I noticed that you haven't been able to get this task done yet, and I wanted to just check in and see what might be going on, how I could help out, or what made it hard to get to this. Whatever it is, using your own language, that's the A for ask. And then P in the REAP model is making a plan, right? So how are you actually going to, in that asking, identify the root cause and collectively develop a plan to remedy it? Do they need more information? Do they need support? Do they need permission to feel like they can back down from it? Whatever it might be, the key with the REAP model is assuming positive intent counteracts the blame bias. It allows us to really unlock any of our volunteers. Chances are almost every single person that you've worked with in your time with CCL or in other organizations has bumped into one of these roadblocks. And using that REAP model kind of unlocks that potential again, gets them out of that indirect motivator cycle where they're only doing things because they're feeling guilted into it, or they don't know how to kind of say no or whatever it is, and really overcome barriers so that they can try new things and feel good about whatever contributions you identify as a plan together. So that is the REAP model. And all right, so let's jump into the fifth pillar. And then this one, I think in particular, is one that all of you are actively practicing already. So we're kind of putting some framework or some language around it. So the fifth pillar in particular is emphasizing the importance of doing things together, helping people determine their own role, and checking in with them periodically to help lead to that greater engagement. There really isn't a formula for empowering individuals, right? But those key areas, and we'll kind of review each of those a little bit more in depth, are really what we found in that fifth pillar to be critical for empowering volunteers. So let's talk about each of them here. So the first thing, in increasing volunteer engagement, and this again looks different in the COVID era, but you can still do things together. It might just be a bit different than what we did pre-2019. So how do we do things together? I think one of the other interesting things that both of these books got into is that we often think that by setting up people to work alone on tasks, we're more efficient and fast. But research highlights that people actually engage deeper over time, more deeply, when they do that work shared together. So again, don't be rigid about it, but I know a lot of you looking around the room here, the Zoom room, do co-working. And whether it's in person, whether it's on Zoom, having an opportunity to kind of share in that work so it's not just a solo action can really strengthen that group identity and ask people into that process together. So especially also co-leaders can help then keep that work from feeling overwhelming, providing support, accountability. Adding a second person to a job really opens them up to obviously bringing their skill set in. So it's not just your own skill set as the experience of what's bringing that up. And it also builds in redundancy. For all the engineers out there, it's good to have backup, right? If you've got one person and everything on that role is riding on them, and all of a sudden they get sick or there's a conflict or a crisis, the whole work falls apart. So doing that work together, I think, is really key in the empowerment of volunteers. Now, the next thing that we want to get to kind of practicing, and we've got some great training by Gene Rytok and others on specifically asking, learning how to make requests, is to move people into being empowered by asking them to really take a commitment and make that goal. And you can do that yourself. You can do that by, as a group leader, asking others. And again, as you make that ask, as we practiced even, with the Senate reconciliation campaigns this summer, you can ask very directly and say, I have a favor to ask. You're very welcome to say no, but here's really what would help out right now. We're really in need of this. Or this is an area that we really would love to find some leadership in. Are you interested in trying it on for size? Whatever it is, making that direct ask and allowing them to then respond with an affirmative, with a counteroffer, by saying, no, unfortunately, I'm not able to do that right now. Each of those is equally acceptable. And if you're doing this on your own front, developing roles for your volunteers or for yourself, we found this kind of template to be really helpful. And essentially what that allows you to do in defining a role, again, if we're moving from joiners to task doers to role takers, and kind of defining your role, you can name this three-part area. So as your title, as the media monitor for CCL Charlottesville, I will check XXX, these three papers or sources of online news once a week, and the deliverable, by activities, give that back to, my chapter to invite them to write LTEs. So you can think of this as a very simple three-part formula to help empower your main your role takers to transition from task doers and have a specific title to help them be invited with an honorific way into that shared work together as a chapter. And I think the key thing also that you had mentioned earlier, Cynthia, that I really loved, is that as you get to know your members, your volunteers, you can begin listening for what it is they like doing and, propose possible roles and co-collaborate with them, right? To think, to help them think of what role they want to play. You did that perfectly in that example, right? And so it's a collaborative process. You can match up what the group needs, what the people in it are interested in doing. And when you've got that, secret sauce of people doing what they're enjoying doing and believe in and want to be improving in, and it's benefiting your group, that's exactly kind of where that intersecting need is so critically met. And the last thing that we want to highlight on this fifth pillar is the importance of not just, starting the top off in a spin motion, but checking in occasionally on that to make sure everything's still spinning, right? You don't just want to kind of have that one conversation and, okay, great, talk to you again in 3 years. How do you have a structure where you are checking in with your people? And again, relationships dictate the frequency, the length, the format, but thinking through the importance of coaching as leaders is equally critical in that fifth pillar's work. And in this guide, what we think through are three overlapping domains in our coaching. We want to, as leadership developers, provide motivation. And by that, we mean encouraging, being the cheerleader on the side, helping people identify barriers, getting over their sense of discouragement or despondence, helping them really identify what they're interested in, being that motivator. We also want them to feel like they have the skill set that they need. So you as a coach can help them build up that muscle, help them exercise becoming a better letter writer, or eventually maybe even an opinion editorial writer by, starting with just an LTE writing workshop and kind of helping cultivate their growth in the skill set that they're interested in continuing to deepen. And if you don't have it, chances are you don't know everything. Who can you connect them with in your chapter, in your local community, to be that mentor with them, to kind of be that sage, on the side, the guide on the side to help them move forward. And then lastly, your other role is thinking through, kind of taking a step back and identifying how they can have that larger 360 view on how their goals achieve the larger chapter purpose, which unlocks the state's goals, which ultimately influences CCL's national push. How can you kind of help strategize? And, maybe you've got a team of 50 people that like bringing snacks to your next meeting. Well, that's really helpful. But if you're only doing that, chances are you're maybe overdeveloped in one area. So how can you have a strategic view as a group leader, you know, to, as a leadership developer, to have a well-rounded chapter and really cultivate and bring in almost like, again, a conductor, a very favorite metaphor of ours, to really bringing out a lot of these different skill sets across all of the levers. And one of the ways that we kind of provide coaching advice in this guide is with a sample conversation. I won't read through the whole thing here, but again, a shout out if anyone's interested. I know Debbie's already put this in the chat. The full guide's available. If you just search CCL Community for Transformational Organizing, it's the top hit. And you can think through in that conversations with your people, finding out what they need, finding a way to fill that need, and then reflecting back and iterating out. So what worked well? What did you learn? What can we do better? And applying that to the next conversation. So the reason why I wanted to conclude with this is that it's not the last word or the only word on how, you know, we can effectively empower each other. But I think the act of creating this guide hopefully provided a sense of useful information and a framework for us as leadership developers in CCL to experiment with and build on. So again, as we said, as the beginning of this guide's launch, we trust you to try things out, see what works for you, share successes, failed attempts with others so that we can keep improving and growing together as an organization. But please feel free as you continue to reach out and try all of these approaches, you know, to continue to think through and share what's kind of working for you in your own group development. And we're only going to be as effective as, you know, what we can learn from each other in this process. So I hope that tonight was useful, that it led to some inner discoveries for your own chapter and state and regions applications. And please stay in touch. As you know, here's how to get in touch with me for feedback. And here's a link to our overall forums. So with that, I will stop sharing so we can see each other's smiling faces. And I'll unmute everyone so we can hear each other too. Thank you, everyone.
Bye. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you, Brett.
Thanks, Brett. Thank you.
Okay. Good to see you, Fred.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.